to another world. Another world of paranormal African stories. I am the Grizzly. This is episode 6. Remember to send us your views via our email, talesfromtheheart@gmail.com. Visit our Twitter handles as well. Check the description for all details. This week, we have 2 stories for you. You must like them. Pay attention. I know a place where you can find the dead. I know a place where you can find the living. Come with me as I take you through our first story, titled Welcome Back or Not. It had been 5 weeks since Nene's husband was kidnapped, and it had been 4 weeks since Nene dropped the ransom cash of 10 million naira at the designated spot chosen by the kidnappers. Yet, her husband wasn't home. Truth be told, the kidnappers had not actually assured her that he would be returned home. They had simply stated that she should bring the ransom if she wanted to see her husband alive again. Nene had refused to involve the police because she believed it would hurt the chances of her husband returning home alive. So, after collecting the monies donated by her family, her husband's family, her friends, his friends, and their church, she had traveled 2 hours to get to the spot where she dropped the cash, as requested by the kidnappers. After she had dropped the cash at the spot, the kidnappers called her and told her to return home and await her husband's return. He never returned. Nene was in agony. The phone number which the kidnappers had called her with was switched off. Even her husband's line, which at least used to ring while in their captivity, was also switched off. She was confused and terrified at what it all meant. She didn't understand why he wasn't back home. After all, she had dropped off the ransom and had also not involved the police. She wondered what she had done wrong. A desperate Nene began to visit miracle promising churches, seers, native doctors, and anyone who promised to offer a spiritual eye that would search and locate the whereabouts of her husband. Although every one of them told her that he was alive and would make his way home, Nene had a feeling that the kidnappers murdered him. When she had expressed these thoughts to her mother-in-law, the woman screamed at her and stopped talking to her. The police, whom she later involved when her husband failed to return, had found no corpse at and around the spot where she had dropped off the ransom. One evening, a family friend who kept abreast with Nene's situation came visiting. This concerned family friend told Nene about a place where the dead could be reached. The place, a town actually, is called Amalama, and it is in eastern Nigeria. It is said that if you've lost someone, an Igbo person I presume, chances are you will find him or her living, or more like existing, in this town like a human. Apparently, these living dead marry, procreate, and have daily jobs like you and I. And no, this town, Amalama, isn't a phantom town. is right there, next to another town of non-dead living humans. So, this concerned friend had assured Nene that Amalanma was a real place, and they would find out if her husband was there. And if they found him there, it would mean he is dead, and Nene will then mourn him properly and move on with her life. A desperate Nene agreed to visit the town, so the next day, armed with hazy directions and a picture of her husband, they set off for the village of the living dead. Surprisingly, the town had been easy to locate. People were eager to help them whenever they asked for directions and wished them luck in finding the answers they sought. Nene and her family friend found a rider of a commercial motorcycle who took them to the outskirts of the town and advised them to walk the rest of the way. Although the town wasn't hidden, people from neighboring towns preferred to steer clear of its inhabitants. After all, there should be no business between the living and the dead, even if the dead chooses to stay back on Earth. Nene and her family friend had to walk through a bush path before emerging at a clearing that had a boundary marker made from red cloth, cowries, tortoise shell, and some dried palm fronds. There, they also found a shrine that looked like a crudely built toll gate. Surrounding the shrine were lots and lots of crows. It was most unnerving as the crows had seemed unbothered by their presence. While Nene and her family friend debated even how to move forward, an old man emerged from the shrine. It was obvious that he was blind from cataracts, yet he moved and acted like he had his sight. Without asking Nene the purpose for her visit, the old man asked for the picture she had brought with her, and when she handed over to him, he raised it to the sky and cawed like a crow. Nene and her family friend watched in trepidation as a crow flew through the old man's raised hand and swiped the picture before flying away. Nene's family friend boasted courage to ask the chief priest if Nene's husband was dead or alive. She got no response from him. The chief priest simply turned toward Nene and, in a measured tone, told her to go back home and prepare her husband's favorite meal. It was a skeptic Nene who had returned home that evening. Nevertheless, she did as the chief priest said. Every morning, afternoon, and night, she would prepare her husband's favorite meal and leave it covered on the dining table. 3 days passed, and her husband was a no-show. Nene was just about calling it a waste of time when she woke up to a knock on her door on the morning of the fourth day. It was her husband. Everyone was happy. Thanksgiving was held at church. Family and friends trooped in to welcome him back. But in all that, everyone noticed something was off. Nene's husband had lost his memory. He only remembered his wife, Nene, and had to be reintroduced to every other person, including his parents. Everyone who visited or heard of his memory loss came to the conclusion that it was as a result of the trauma of the kidnap experience. Nene also noticed something else. Her husband was different. He had always been a boisterous fellow, but since his return, he said few words and was always brooding. It bothered her, but her happiness at his return overtook whatever concerns she had. 3 months after his return, Nene got a call. She was wanted at the police station as soon as possible. It was when the call ended that she realized she had neglected to inform the police of her husband's return. She told her husband about the call and her plan to inform them of his return so that his name would be struck off the list of missing persons. She asked if he would accompany her, but he politely declined. Not wanting to press him, Nene said she understood and left for the police station. At the station, she was informed that her husband's kidnappers had been apprehended and had led them to the site where they buried his body. She was called to identify what was left of the body. The birthmark on the torso of the corpse resembled the description she had written in her statement after the kidnappers bailed with the ransom she had paid for her husband's return. Nene thanked the police for their efforts and informed them that her husband was back, well and alive. She refused to take a look at the body, even though the kidnappers kept insisting that they had shot him multiple times after she had delivered the ransom, and were very sure he had died because they had been the ones who buried him. Nene left the police station irritated and went back home, where she met the absence of her husband. The door had been locked from outside. Even though Nene hadn't been bothered at his absence because she had assumed he went out, she was surprised to find that he had left his new phone behind. Another new quirk of his was his obsession with his phone. Irritation turned to anger, and anger turned to fear when the hours passed and her husband was nowhere to be found. Nene went into full panic mode when night came and passed, and more nights came and passed with her husband nowhere in sight. At the insistence of the police, Nene's husband's family went to identify the corpse which the kidnappers claimed was her husband. And yes, the body was indeed their son and her husband. When she was given the news, Nene fainted and had to be taken to the hospital. It was while she was there that the doctor informed her that she was 3 weeks pregnant. Sometimes you have to choose where you want to go, but other times your destination chooses you. Our second and final story is titled Highway to Hell. Enjoy. How many of you have been able to conquer your phobia? If you haven't, it's because you haven't stood between the devil, and I mean devil literally, and the deep blue sea. The deep blue sea representing your phobia in this context. Well, I have been able to conquer mine, more like choose to face it, because I have come to realize why the idiom highway to hell, but not railway or air route to hell, exists. The owners of that idiomatic expression were being literal. Now, let me tell you a short story. I am an auditor with a big corporation. We've got so many clients all over the country, and as one of the best auditors they have, I get to visit these client companies bi-monthly. As a result, I am always on the move from one auditing job to another. Yeah, it is a great job. I love the opportunity to travel, plus the par diem. You would think that someone like me with such a busy itinerary would be hopping from one airport to another. No, I am scared of airplanes and flying. That is, until now. My phobia for all things airplanes and flying meant that I was always on the road. In order not to wear myself out, I always took the 9 bus. 9 travel was my favorite because it afforded me the opportunity to rest in between trips. Also, I considered it safer than day road travel. There were less careless drivers and cars on the road that night. So this had been my style of travel for 7 years, till last month when I and my fellow passengers encountered something which since then keeps me awake every night. After spending 4 days at Joss auditing a food packaging company, I boarded a 9 bus, a Sienna to be specific, heading to Enugu. I was to spend 3 days in Enugu, auditing one of the biggest transport companies there. We set out at 8 p.m. on the dot. The journey was going so well. Nice co-passengers, good driver. Funny too, cause he kept regaling us with stories of his childhood. Like I said, the journey was going quite well. At some point, while my co-passengers and the drivers were talking animatedly, I dozed off, and that sleep was interrupted when I was almost thrown out of my chair. I had not used my seatbelt. It seemed like we had hit a bump, and the screams of my co-passengers almost gave me a heart attack. I heard the tires of the Sienna screech as it came to a halt. For some seconds, no one said anything. The glaring headlights of the Sienna enabled us to see each other, and I could see fear and worry in the eyes of my fellow passengers. When I glanced at the driver, I found him gripping the steering wheel while staring and blinking at his side mirror. What was he staring at? I wondered. The air was still, like everyone was holding their breath. Did your brake fail? My question had punctured the still air. No one responded, but they all looked like they were frozen in time. I craned my neck to look behind us and saw nothing. It was then that one of the passengers, a lady, chose to speak.
We hit someone, a woman, I think. I believe we ran over her. Jesus,
she whispered as she clutched her head. When I glanced at the driver, he was still staring at whatever it was he was seeing. Annoyed at his attitude, I told him to open the door so we could check on the woman. It wasn't right to hit and run, or in this case, hit and watch. The driver took his eyes off the side mirror and slowly turned toward me.
"I don't think so, person,"
he muttered.
"What do you mean? Is this how you want to justify this? Open this door so I can check on whatever it is if you don't want to. By the way, where are we?"
I demanded. It was then that my co-passengers seemed to come out of the shock they had and joined in demanding me check on the person our car had run over. I remember that the driver sighed heavily before unlocking the door. One by one, we came out of the vehicle, except for the glaring head and rear lights of the Sienna. Everywhere was pitch black. The road was deserted, and it was clear
that we were in the middle of nowhere because we couldn't see light anywhere in sight. I would be lying if I said I wasn't afraid, as I led others to the spot pointed out by one of the passengers with my phone torchlight. The driver had locked the car and joined us too, although reluctantly. I think he didn't like the idea of being left alone. We saw nothing. My fellow passengers saw that they had seen the woman just before the car hit and ran over her. But there was nothing on the road. We walked farther up just in case, but there was nothing. No streak of blood on the tarred road, no pieces of cloth, nothing. It was then that terror caught us all. Well, except the driver, because he kept saying, "Shebi ateluna, shebi ateluna, see the person." As we hurried back to the car, just as we got close, the head and rear lights of the Sierra started to blink aggressively, and the radio came on. It switched from one radio station to another, and the volume was at its highest. It was then that the driver started shouting, "No be me dey do am," repeatedly, as he showed us his keys. Of course, he was not the one doing it, because almost immediately, the trunk of the Sienna flew open, and one by one, our luggage was flung at us, and we could see no one in the car. Ah, the way we prayed. The way we screamed blood of Jesus as we fled into the bush, hot on one another's tail. It was as if we subconsciously knew that we were better off together than apart. We found ourselves under a tree that night, and after a brief deliberation, we decided to spend the night under the tree. One of the passengers noted that there was no network service in the area, and when I checked my phone, it was true. I don't think we slept much. In between the praying and speaking in tongues by some of my co-passengers, however, at dawn, we were awoken by the driver. He motioned us for us to listen, and when we did, we heard the sounds of moving vehicles. We ran out of the bush and found ourselves on the highway. I believe, and everyone echoed the same thing, that this was the highway where we had encountered whatever it was. But the Sienna was nowhere to be found. And the luggage that had been thrown at us had disappeared too. We discovered there was network in that area, so the driver made a call to his boss, who made an arrangement to pick up the 7 of us. I don't know the story he gave to his boss, and I didn't ask. While we waited by the side of the road, our peachy state and look of despair attracted some good Samaritans who stopped to see how they could help us. We found no words to describe what we had passed through, so we told everyone who asked that we had been attacked by armed robbers who made away with our car. When the substitute car sent by the company arrived to pick us, we were so relieved. The substitute driver told us that there was nothing they could do about our luggage, but they could ensure that we reached our destination. Our substitute car pulled away with us in it, and a kilometer away from where we'd been picked, we found a small crowd gathered at the side of the road. It looked like they were staring at something in the ravine, which was off the highway. Suddenly, one of my co-passengers gave a shout. She had caught a glimpse of one of the clothes she had packed for her trip, laying on the grass, close to the crowd. We spilled out of the car and ran across the road to join the crowd.
And right inside the ravine was the Sienna. It was totally wrecked, and our luggage was strewn all over the place. After pleading with some young men in the crowd, they went into the ravine and picked as much luggage as they could for us. I was only able to retrieve some of my clothes. As for my papers and laptop, they were damaged. We drove off in silence, grateful for escaping whatever violent entity we had encountered. As for me, it marked a turning point in my life. I have just bought a flight ticket to Kaduna. I'd rather deal with suspended aluminium and cabin pressure than an invisible and mean entity on the road. That has been our stories for this week. I hope you enjoy them, because you must. Maybe next time we can read your own paranormal story. Check the description below for our contact. These stories for this week's episode were written by Adachukwu Onwudue and narrated by yours truly, The Grizzly. Sound was produced and mixed by Blue Magic OD of Magic City. Also check him out on Twitter at @BlueMagic_OD. Tales from the Heart is a production of Creator Library and Publisher, a digital library and publishing platform that provides equitable access to research and knowledge resources. Check it out at www.thecreatorlibrary.com. You can check the description for all of these details. Thank you very much, and behave yourself. Goodbye.